I'm Dr. Demento, and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Democracy is an experiment, and so is community radio. During this fall membership drive, KBOO will take a deep dive into democracy in all its forms, from current events to music programs. KBOO is your community connection. We're non-commercial and independent. We're supported by our members. So show your support by becoming a member of KBOO today. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. You can also mail a donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland,
Oregon. What's happening? This is that boy Young Queez. This is another episode of 10 Can Phone today. You know, I got the gang with me. Joe, what's happening?
What's going on, Queez? Man, I'm just happy to be sitting here with you guys. I mean, Armand and Michael. It's great to see you guys, man. How are you doing, Armand?
You know, little Joe, I'm doing my thing. I'm holding in. This is Armand Pouce, Pouce Face, the artist formerly known as Armand Pouce Bazan. Mike, how you doing over there? Living the dream?
You know, living the dream is what I say. I've lately been saying living and breathing because the dream is slightly beyond my fingertips and is maybe even a metric for what we're talking about today. Queez, what are we doing today?
I 10 can phone in this month. Hey, today, man, we're gonna talk about the importance. I wanna bring light to the importance of transitioning. I wanna bring light to the importance of being focused, aware, conscious, and subject for change upon coming home. So today, 10 can phone, 30 days out.
Mike and Armand, Joe, Queez, we the ones that you can depend on to bring the voices from the inside out. Locked down, but they not locked out. No filter over here. Check what we be talking about. Feet up in the trenches, bop. While you're on defenses, metal detector before you enter. Shaky medical and see your stitches. They be pushing their weight around. Educate, didn't have the time to wait around. Taking classes while they played around. That's what we call staying down. What we call staying down. That's what we call staying down. Mike, Armand, Joe, Queez. Dang, is this 10 can phone?
Wow. 30 days out, baby. 30 days out.
And I just want to say, Queez, you mean 30 days out of prison, right?
Yeah.
I was thinking that too. Yeah.
Okay. No, it's relevant. You don't know. 10 can phone from where? What's going on? Inside out.
In and out, in and out. 30 days in, 30 days out. We speaking on the out stove. And Joe, I'm coming straight to you.
Okay.
You the freshest out. You just about at that 30 or a little bit more.
So exactly, Joe, how many days out of prison are you?
I got out on June 22nd, and today is August 1st of 2020. So it's roughly 6 weeks, 36 days maybe a little less. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's nothing like I imagined it would be. I have actually been telling people recently that, like, because somebody somehow got into like a conversation with me about how I value myself, or how I, she asked me, like, what, you know, well, didn't you feel good getting out of prison? And I hadn't thought about it, but everybody tells you before you get out that you're going to feel like $1 million. That's what I heard all the time. And I felt like dispensable when I was walking out. I felt like I could, you know, just be used up and sort of discarded.
when you say that, I can't grasp fully what that means, like why or
like, I mean,
who's using
well, I guess so. How a person imagines they will appraise themselves when they're released and they earn their freedom back, they imagine that they, I mean, I imagined I would have all of this value, I guess, in my potential. Like I felt like I was resting on all this potential that had built up throughout my years in prison, and that like getting out would launch me into like what, like a platform to use that potential, to raise it up and cultivate it. And I walked out with like my plastic bag full of possessions, you know, like an oatmeal box carrying old letters and some like vinyl bag that my underwear came in, that I was using to like hold envelopes, like all just these silly things, a coffee mug is moldy now at my grandparents' house. And I felt like I was, you know, I felt like I was being sold at like a sale price.
Then so real quick, so Joe and everyone that at home or new listening to the Tin Can Phone, Joe went in to prison at 18 years old, and he had just been released now. What does math work, Joe? How old are you?
I'm 23. So this is 5 years.
So he did from 18 to 23 locked up, and this young man is going through his experience of coming home.
And let's contextualize a little bit. And even, I mean, I'm sure I've heard the story, but, or at least I know the arc in a way. Where did you go first? You know, like what institutions and what were those institutions?
Okay.
What was your tour? See, in the incarcerated world, which yeah, I don't
Lingo,
want to
be. What's up? Lingo, what's up?
We call it a tour. Because the prison, what they like to do is, wherever you're from, they're going to try to send you the furthest away from there. Because again, where you're from and being at that institution becomes a carrot dangled over your head. You want to be close to your family. You want to be close to get visits. You got to be good. You got to do this. You got to finish this program. So we call it a tour, because usually when you come to prison, you're not going to stay at one nor the one that's closest to where you're from. So we just, what was your tour like? You feel me? Like
well, it's exactly like you just described. But before I go on, I just want the listeners to understand the difference. Like when you say it was a tour, it might make people think of like a tour on active duty in the military. And it's just like, I just don't want anybody to, I guess, deviate from what you're trying to say, Quiz, because it's so different from that kind of tour.
No, but it's like not, a, though. But it's not though. Because yeah. See, I'm a repeat offender. Mind you, this is Rockstar Quiz, Misfit Adi. I'm a repeat offender, right? So every time I go to the pen, it's another tour for me, because it is a war zone. I got gang ties, you feel me? I not only gang ties, I got street ties, I got organization ties. So when I go to the pen, it is a tour, because we going to war. You feel me? I'm one of the guys that I've been a part of 4 different riots. I've spent over 18 months, probably 2 years in solitary confinement in my whole time. So it is. When we say a tour, we mean it just like going to Iraq. Or
I know,
just like,
and I don't want to spend too much time on this little point that I brought up, but I do want to say that like it differs from a tour in the military, in the fact that, for one, like you didn't elect to do this yourself. You were sent there, and you're not standing up for a nation or like the fake hate of a nation's cause. You have nothing to believe in but like your own survival, and like you are not, you're on a tour alone. Like mm-hmm. there's hardly any comrades with you.
Mm-hmm.
And even those ones are just it's like it's some fickle relationship that it only exists because you live next to the guy.
Yes.
So yeah, like you're not a part of a nation. You're not coming from anywhere besides another lost place. And that's why I have a hard time seeing it as a tour, like one in the military.
It's interesting because I wasn't thinking of when Quiz mentioned tour. I mean, I'm familiar with various prison jargons, but was new to me, and really was just thinking of it like as a guided tour, like, you know, moving around. But kind of the layers is certainly interesting. And before you describe your tour, I wanted to share with the audience. So Joe's 23. 23 is young and a confusing time in the best of circumstances, but also was thinking as you were kind of describing the corollary between prison lingo tour and the normative tour at war, how kind of profound and wise our young Joe is. So yeah, you listen with that in your mind. Yeah, anyway, Joe, where did you go and when?
So I first went to Washington County Jail on June 25th. That's when I got arrested. That was my first experience ever going to jail, ever being in handcuffs, ever being in the back of a police car. And I just think of myself as like brain dead. Like, imagine being put in a situation with your brain shut off and people asking you to still live and function and provide for yourself. That's how I felt. Because they don't really break down the rules when you go to jail. They just tell you what you can't do. Mm. And so you don't really know what you need, like what you need to do. You don't really know what you should do. And like, I remember being handed like a roll of clothes and a blanket and like a little plastic bag with a toothpaste and a toothbrush. And they said, walk down the hall to pod 4. And everybody was looking at me like I was like entirely just like a suspicious. And yeah, that was my first place.
That was like before your arraignment or whatever.
Yeah, that was where I was. Like, that's where they hold you before they bring you to your arraignment and your preliminary hearing and your like some pretrial conference. And then you have after the pretrial conference is when they do that like plea bargaining. And calling it bargaining, because I just imagine like a lawyer and a DA eating salad together, discussing like, you know,
bro,
like,
they play like Monopoly with our lives. That's how they do
your lawyer is like, he's in between chewing on his salad with blue cheese dressing. He's trying to like do damage control while the DA is like, no, man, fuck that guy. And your lawyer is like, well, yeah, I know. I mean, he's like, fuck him, but come on, like, give me a break here. Give me a break on this deal and I'll kind of back off on that other one.
Right.
And you're just like that whole time, if you could just juxtapose an image of me in my cell while that conversation's going on, it would seem so pathetic that I'm sitting there twiddling my thumbs, like wondering if lunch will come sooner than I expect it to. sooner than I'm willing to wait. But anyway, I mean, that was my first.
That's a really interesting portrait to paint, and is interesting in this kind of contemporary dialogue about prison and abolition and its corollary to slavery. And that is like part of one of the deeper nuances as I continue to advance my own kind of knowledge and awareness around that and the Black experience. And like a lot of the way it's kind of discussed in certain contexts is they refer to it in its whole entity, which is chattel slavery, which is kind of like both the purchase and sale of people and bodies, Black bodies, and also kind of this ability to essentially, I don't even know.
I'll tell you what, Jal. So it was the first time that slavery was in which personal property over human. So it was the first time that slaves had been, as far as like an economic property, and then completely dehumanized.
Well, yeah.
I think that
the point I was going to make is that essentially these like white men are walking through checking teeth and poking and prodding bodies. But the specific point of it is that they are also, because of property or whatever reason, legally permitted to like rape and breed these slaves or people for the purposes of essentially economic gain. And so as when Joe was telling his story, it's just interesting, right? Because people talk about prison being modern day slavery, and essentially how like probably mostly white men negotiating over people and time and these whole lives over salad.
Well, and you have to imagine too that I don't know if it's openly discussed between a lawyer and a DA, because it's not relevant to either of their goals, but like there is a financial element to these plea agreements and the time that is given to people. There is an economic impact and gain somewhere happening. And like I said, it doesn't maybe happen over that salad, but when you discuss slavery and how it fits in, how it was like, I mean, it was a part of the economy,
Right.
And I guess still is, because it's like some, we're going through some surreptitious form of slavery, some underhanded like guise of a criminal. Yeah.
Yeah. Love it. Or,
anyway.
Love the point we're making about a terrible thing. And yeah, just want to move through your tour so we can continue to reflect on.
Yeah, we sure do get away from that, don't we? Not that I mind.
Many pitfalls fall in this context.
But, well, there's just so many kind of things you'd like to talk about. Yep. Anyway, the one thing we are here to talk about. I was at Washington County Jail for about 4.5 months, and that was a whole like trauma in itself, because not only was I like wondering where the hell I was going to end up, but I had all these people who were schooling me for where I was going to go. Like all these guys, and they were white guys because we were racially segregated, and like these older white men immediately told me that I was to like be crowded with them, grouped with them. And they were telling me how to behave once I got to prison. And I was always trying to tell these guys like, no, I'm not going to prison. I'm not going to prison. And of course I was the one who didn't know any better, and I ended up going. But like they were like schooling me for this tour, so to speak, or preparing me for it. And not because they were looking out for me, but because they wanted me to conform to the way life is supposed to be lived once you get there. And so I signed a plea agreement for 5 years. And I remember that day I came back from meeting with my lawyer, sat on my bed, and my cellie was like, well, what was that about? And I said, well, I just signed a deal for 5 years. And he's like, well,
record deal?
Sort of. I'm pretty sure the time was recorded. My time was recorded on a document called a 400, all of my purchase history in prison that they used against me. But no, I told my cellie that I had 5 years, and I was like dangling my feet over the bed, and I did not feel the impact like I thought I was like supposed to. And I had a hearing where I was sentenced, and they sent me off to the intake center, which is Coffee Creek, which, you know, at least three of us here know about. But Michael and the audience, oh, you've been there?
I have been.
Awesome.
That's where they train us.
Not awesome, maybe.
To deal with dangerous criminals.
That's where they train us.
Bite your fingers.
That's where they train us also, but in a different way. It's the intake center. It's where they send you for about roughly 30 days before you get sent to where you're going to do a bulk of your time. And they just, you get like generic clothing and not even a pair of shoes. You get sandals to wear and like a small bar of soap the size of a domino and a bottle of shampoo, a toothbrush, and a tube of clear mint toothpaste and five envelopes. And that's all you have for 30 days. Besides, of course, you know, you're getting like your meals three times a day. And you only get 3 half-hours out a day. And I mean, it's in the beginning of your time, so like everybody there is like grappling with what they have to prepare themselves for. Like you can't become immediately, you can't just say, okay, this is what I'm gonna do. I have to do this. Like it's every day you're struggling with what you have to do and like calculating the time, imagining it, sectioning it off into little pieces that seem digestible. And I got into a fight at Coffee Creek with my neighbor, and it was a foolish situation that didn't need to happen. I imagined that I needed to go through it because of the way that people looked at me. And I went and fought this guy, and I went to the hole for 25 days. And I was in the hole at Coffee Creek for 2 weeks before they sent me to Snake River. And I thought it was going to be okay. I thought, you know, okay, I already did 2 weeks in the hole and it wasn't so bad. And I got to Snake River, and they brought me into this like it looked like an outpost building, through some side door, and all around was just the like white sand of the desert and some dunes with like burned out trees in the distance. And we go into this building and it's all white. They put me in like a little 4x4 room and make me strip naked and give me new clothes. And they take me into this room that's so dark, it's like a dungeon. I mean, there's lights in the ceiling, but it seems like there's not even a candle lit. And there's like bars over the windows of the cell door. And when they put me in there, I sat down and had like less possessions in my life than I've ever had before. A toothbrush not even longer than my thumb, and like a cup of baking soda to brush with. And I spent 2 weeks there, and like listening to people shout at me on the tier, because people would ask me if I was new and what I was in prison for, and like try to like rile me up and like antagonize situations and drama where everyone's just like yelling through a crack in the door. And I heard people discussing the life, like the mainstream life outside of the hole in general population. And I just, I kept sitting on my bed in my cell, which, you know, you're 24 hour lockdown, you don't get to leave. And I just kept wondering, like, how am I going to fit into that? They were using slang, and I was just wondering, what does that even mean? What are they even saying? Half of the things I heard, I didn't even know how to picture or imagine. And then I was just thrown up into general population. And my first day at Snake River, after the hole, I walked onto this unit, and the CEO looked at me, the officer, and he was like, "What gang are you in?" And I said, "None." And he laughed at me, and he goes, "Which one are you going to be in? Who are you going to be a torpedo for?" And I said, "Nobody." And he like just looked away for a minute and sighed, and it's like he just didn't even believe me. And he sent me off to me. He's like, "All right, you're in cell 28. And I walked up there, and people were like shouting at me, looking at me. You could see like every single face in the glass looking as I walked up the stairs, and it was horrible. Like, I felt like I was in an arena. And I mean, I walked up to my cell, and I was there by myself, and I sat down, and I had no idea what was going to come. And I mean, I'm not going to get into too detailed like narrative about every day after that, but I ended up getting into another fight, and doing 30 days in the hole, but finally made it out and adjusted into a life that I was able to maintain for several years. And I was at Snake River for about 3 years and doing well at the end of that. I had worked several different jobs. I had just gotten a job in like this brand new unit. It was like this like privileged housing unit. And I got moved to Complex One, which is like the easiest place. Like, you know, you have to have like a year and a half clear conduct to be over there, so nobody gets in trouble. It's really easy. Nobody bothers each other. I was there for like 2 weeks, and they rolled me up to go. They told me I was going to minimum. And I asked them if I could stay. I asked them if I could stay at Snake River. And they were kind of confused. They're like, "No, you can't. You have to go." And I was like, "But I've lived my life here for 3 years. I know how to do it here. I know that my days will pass here because they already have. There's evidence for it." And I like, you gotta let me. And they said, "No, it's like it's in the computer. Like, it's been told to us from the Capitol." So I went the next morning and ended up at Deer Ridge.
Which is interesting that you don't have a choice, even though it's kind of like meant to be a reprieve. It's interesting that you don't have a choice.
Yeah. It's people are normally excited for transport. I mean, I knew I was before it happened. And then when it finally came to me and they said, "This is what's happening," I tried my best to reject it. Anyway, after that, I went to Madras, a place called Deer Ridge, and I stayed there for 3 months before I was transferred to another minimum in Portland called Columbia River Correctional Institution, which is where we all met at CRCI. And that's where this project started. And I was there for about 6 months before I got in trouble and went to the hole. And I was just so fucked up about going to the hole. And I felt like I had made so much progress. We made this podcast. I was in these social justice groups and the art class, Art and Social Practice, which is where we met and did other things besides this podcast. And I was also at a privileged housing unit there. Like, I just refused to go back. And of course, that was that raised my custody level, refusing to get out of the hole. And they sent me to Pendleton, Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution. And I was there for about 4 months or 6 months. And that was a whole awful experience by itself. The most violent prison I've been to. Numerous occasions you'd walk into the chow hall and there's already like a three-person brawl happening, where you're like eating your pancakes in the morning, trying to swallow them the best you can and chew them, because it's a fucking task. And, you know, people behind you just start, there's erupting in violence, and you have to like choke down the rest of your meal trying not to breathe in the pepper spray.
Wow.
Luckily I didn't get into any problems there. And then for my last 6 months, they sent me to OSCI, Oregon State Correctional Institution. And I was there from this last December in 2019 to June 22nd. And that was probably the most awful experience I had through my whole incarceration. But that's not this conversation. So
that sounds like a conversation. Story if I ever heard.
This conversation is coming home, please. I know you have things to say. But your first 30 days out, please. I mean, you've done multiple tours. So I guess giving context to more so this conversation is Young Joe didn't have any street ties, if you understand me. The audience at home understands this. Joe didn't have no street ties. He wasn't about that life in the sense that he was naive to what he was getting into. And what he was dealing with. Yeah. I know something you spoke upon. Again, this is not my politics because I've ran a different type of way of doing life before I went to prison.
Yeah.
But I also did not have any exclusive ties to any organization. So I think from that context, you understand the idea of like almost what an honor it can be to get that first, you know, tour out the way.
Yeah.
Opposed to Joe, who is going in as an independent white guy with no context and looking like fresh money, and look at even the corrections officers, if you notice, mm-hmm. said that Joe's looking like he's gonna be a torpedo. Mm-hmm. For those that don't know what a torpedo is, crash dummy, they got, again, different ways to say from wherever you're from, but like, mm-hmm. that means you look like a young person that these other people will take advantage of to do violence against others that they mm-hmm. have other agendas against. And that's something, obviously, you see a lot of.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I wanted to bring it back to you, Quiz, too, in coming home and how I guess you've done multiple tours.
Yeah.
So I guess give us a thought. You don't have to take us all the way through your tours in this episode.
Yeah.
But give like your thought process of coming home in each of those tours.
So it's different for me. I respect and I do understand Joe's journey because it wasn't a tour. It was a journey for him. But I come from a hardball lane on the streets. I do come from a gang culture. But in prison, not only gang culture, because that kind of it is existence, but it's a race culture too, though. And I come from a place where you can't even gain certain stripes until you walk a yard. You can't even get so high in your organization until you've done so much time on the prison yard, right? So me coming in, it was automatically a war zone. And so anytime you get moved to a different prison, the only worries is, am I gonna know anybody? Is it gonna be cool? Like, who here? Like, all these things is because of you trying to escape war, violence. Feel me? Where we at with it? I'm coming looking for that. So for Quiz, I fell out of Monoma County. I'm from Sacramento, California, but I fell out of Monoma County, which is Portland, Oregon. And that's a war zone within itself. I'm coming into a situation of politics that's not my gang, not my hood, not even my state. But when I, you know, it's the law of attraction. What you put off is what you're gonna get. And you feel me? I'm out here like that. So I'm gonna automatically attract the people that's out here like that. Mm-hmm. And when we get to prison, my whole thing, as soon as I get to jail, hey, who got the keys? Keys being who's in charge or who's the spokesperson for each race and who's running the unit for that race. My mentality, who got the keys in here? You feel me? Cause I wanna holler at whoever got the keys for the blacks. And me and him gonna do one or two things. We gonna get an understanding and I'm gonna hold the keys with you, or me and you gotta go take care of that and I'm gonna take the keys from you. Only two things that could happen here, right? That's county. Once you get to that main line, it moves a little different because of politics. But all in all, it's still a war. Like, I've been a part of four riots, my guy. I've been a part of four race riots. It's a war against others and the police. You feel me? So when I say I went on a tour, like, I really went on a tour because every institution I hit, we getting it popping. Like, I didn't get the luxury to just, you know, come to prison and just fit in or just find my place, I couldn't do that because my first bid, your neighborhood, people who's been in prison before you, you gonna get judged by these things. So it wasn't me coming to prison like, oh, that's Quiz from Sacramento, let's judge him off of him. No, that's Quiz from G Parkway. You know, I ran into one of them G Parkways before him. So I gotta react to his interaction with somebody from my organization before I ever met this dude.
Right.
I gotta look at, go ahead, Mike.
When we keep on like referring to these things as a tour, I finally like got a hold of what I was thinking about earlier. It's weird to think because when you're a prisoner, you're not on your home turf, but at the same time, like if we're thinking about it as a war zone, you are the occupied army. The officers are the occupying army. They're the ones coming in from outside. So it's weird to think of a tour, like when you're on a tour, you're usually the occupying army, but you in prison, you are the occupied and you're still on a tour. Does that make sense?
Yes, it do, Joe, but this is what you got to understand. The COs don't exist to us. You feel me? Like the COs do whatever they do, whatever. Like, bro, they see, and this is the difference. They don't run over here. So the COs can say whatever they want. They can try to book us. You see my is getting sell in, going to the hole. Bro, that don't mean nothing. The COs know better. So if you notice, Joe, COs approach me different. COs approach the top dudes I deal with. They approach it different because they come to us like, look, we know it's trouble between this dude and this dude or this race and this race. Hey, could y'all get it together? Because they know they can't. They know they can't. So they going to come to the dudes that's really in power and like, hey, we need y'all to get this together or we're going to shut this whole motherfucker down. That's their mindset, right? So for other people, they going to bully. They going to push up on. They going to do all that. But when they know that they dealing with a group of people who, you know, most of them probably got life anyway. Some of us got 6, 8, 9, 10 years, measure 11, day for day. What you going to come tell me and me not punch you in your fucking face? This is for CO, though. You feel me? But on top of that, respect. You get respect by the way you move, and CO's going to address you accordingly. I'm not no clown, busy, weird dude. You feel me? So the CO know they could come have a conversation with me. I've never had an indication where somebody thought I was snitching or somebody thought I was telling because I held a conversation with a CO. Because my record and who I am shows that I could have a conversation with the oppressor and not be giving up any information.
You're not compromised.
Yeah. And another thing about tours is, and you notice too, whenever I talk to the CO, you there, being there, like there's somebody there that can hear or an earshot that can hear what's going on. Cause that's how it is in California. You don't talk to the COs by yourself. You don't go to no counselor office by yourself. You don't do that. You gotta take somebody with you, bruh. Cause somebody gotta witness this. But you know, again, it's different. Now, hold on, Joe. Now, mind you this, right?
Go ahead.
Most people, when they choose to go to the Army, they're young. They don't know what they're doing in their life. They're lost. So let me go to the Army or let me go to the Marines to try to find some direction and structure in my life, right? They send you to prison when you're young, naive, and lost, and they want to give you some direction in your life. They gonna send you to prison. Now you go to the war, you fight the war, you stand up for your country, you probably get hooked on heroin or some kind of drugs, you get dishonorable discharge, you come home, you don't have nothing. Like, they don't teach you, all they teaching you is kill. So when you come home from the Army and you come home as a vet, most of the time they're fucked up mentally and physically, right? You go to the pen. They don't teach you nothing. You go in there, you fight, you stab, you survive. You come home with nothing. You feel me? Unless you search education. But you come home with nothing but battle wounds, PTSD, and serious need of therapy.
Nightmares, too. Don't forget
it's
that.
It's a tour, my... Like, if you think about it, they line up with exactly, you know, what you go in but what you come out with. Like, me, and when I came home, my only thought was, how long I'm gonna make it this time, bruh?
Oh,
like,
man.
How long I'm gonna make it this time? Because for me, being free is a vacation. Being free on the streets is like, okay, let me see if I could put these things to use that I learned in the pen. And if not, then I'm gonna go back to the pen and learn some more. So the prison has become home to me. I just did 10 years. Prison has become home to me. The streets is me taking a vacation. Right. So me coming home, I was just thinking, how long I'm gonna last this time? To go thug, to go incorporate some of these new crimes and these things that I learned. How long I'm gonna stay free? Am I gonna stay free? My thought was, am I gonna listen to parole this time?
And I think,
but then when I came home, you know, I came home and I was just like, I held my, now mind you, I was incarcerated for my daughter being born. I held my daughter when she was 3 weeks old. And at that moment, I said, you know what? Hey, she need me. Hey, every one of my decisions is going to affect this little girl. I gotta be there. You feel me? And that was my turnaround. It wasn't nothing prison did. It wasn't no school, no classes. It wasn't none of that. It was me seeing my daughter and realizing when I looked into her eyes that she's the only person in this world that really needs me and that my decisions will really, really affect the way they life turn out. And that's what made me say, you know what? Hey, I'm good, bruh. I'ma still be where I'm at. I still represent what I represent. Never dropped out, never been X'd out, never, like, none of that crazy be going on. My guys respect me because of how I push, how I dealt with these tours, how I dealt with this time. And they respect me and say, you know what? You already did that. Like, my just give us gang. Like, they just want to come and talk to me. Joe, you witnessed this. They just want to come and conversate with me. They just want me to just talk to them. I don't got to go jump out and do no crazy shit to prove to somebody who I am. And that's what people do in prison. They lose themselves trying to prove to other people who they are, or they try to act super tough so they don't get punked. But when you act super tough, it's somebody that's really super tough that's going to want to test that. Again, Misfit Adi said it. Shouts out Kevin Gates. Be yourself. It is cheaper that way. Because those that are like you are going to gravitate to you. And those that don't aren't. They're not going to gravitate to you because they're not like you. Be yourself. It's cheaper that way. Oh, God. So our experiences was different, Joe. And I apologize for not really understanding. I felt cut off when I kept trying to explain what a tour.
No,
and
that's
what
okay.
And I just felt like it wasn't an understanding that was going on with what I meant. But I'm glad I would have cleared that up.
I'm glad that we both expressed our idea of the tour and like how it relates to us differently, just for, I guess, for the audience. And also,
yeah.
We usually have some good discussions like this where we don't disagree about something, but it's not an argument.
Hey, but as far as coming home, though, I need the audience to know, like, anybody that's dealt with or held somebody down or have been in a relationship with an incarcerated individual or previously incarcerated individual, there's a lot of trauma that goes on. Not a lot of trauma, but a lot of normalized trauma. We normalize the horrific things that goes on in there, and we carry those things home with us. So please try to understand that grocery shopping, fast food, restaurant ordering, decision making, these things are challenging, because when we want to grow shopping, we fill out a paper and it comes to us. We fill out a paper and turn it in and it comes to us. When we want to choose what we're going to eat, open up your box. Just open up your locker.
We'll make these a ramen.
These are the things you have to choose from. And as far as decision making, the only decision we have to make is what we watching on TV that night, if we gonna get up and go work out that day, or if we gonna go educate ourselves. So please, if you dealing with anybody that's previously incarcerated or incarcerated, no matter how mentally strong they are, no matter how, you know, advanced you think they are, you have to take your time with us, because we're sensitive creatures coming out of this place. And sometimes our decision-making isn't as fast as you think it should be. Sometimes we have a hard time grocery shopping because we don't know all the different brands. All I know is get me the meat, get me the chicken. I don't know what brand of chicken. I don't know what pack of chicken. I don't know. Just chicken. Just get chicken. You feel me?
It's funny that you bring a lot of this up, because in my first 30 days out, which is still very new, like, people would always ask me, like, where do you want to go? And I'm like, I don't know where there is to go. Please answer that question for me. They're like, well, what do you want to eat? I don't know what there is to eat. I would always be like, well, let's get some oatmeal and some beans, which is all that, which is what you eat in prison.
Yeah.
And so, like, I came home with, like, I shopped at the bulk section in Winco and brought home, like, a bunch of oatmeal and beans and rice and raisins, which are all things that you can buy in prison. My grandparents were like, what are you doing? And I was like, well, I don't know what there is to eat. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I don't know what to buy. There's all these different things. And as far, like, I don't know, people expect you to be restored to your humanity and your rationale.
So, like, so we got, they in my ear, Joe, they're telling us we only got a couple minutes left, like 10 or 20 minutes. There's two things I want to do before we wrap up. Armand, I want to hear a little bit about your journey, because it's interesting. But first, before that, I want Armand to take us out of here. Michael, I want to know what are your thoughts on, or how have you felt about, like, because you've watched us come home. You've watched numerous of us come home, in a sense, like, you've seen us on the inside and out. What do you think, just from hearing and being inside of there and witnessing, remember, I always speak on you being a witness, what do you think the mindset of somebody coming home from, let's just say, 5 years? Like, how do you think, in your perception, if I tell you, Mike, I'm coming home, bro, what is your thought on that instantly? As soon as I tell you, like, I'm coming home, hey, what's up? What we doing, Mike? It's in your hands type.
Good question, Quisha. Yeah, Mike, as a civilian, what would you think after someone just said, hey, they're come home after 5 years?
So, yeah, that's an interesting question. And in my, like, 3 years so far of working with folks who are coming out of institutions, I definitely have seen, like, a wide range of, like, coming home feeling. And ultimately, it seems unilaterally challenged, whether by, like, via the individual or, like, just the various circumstances that they're facing. I've also, I guess, experienced the, like, very normative, or at least, like, and I don't even want to normalize it, but I want to say it's statistically consistent, where folks come out and go back in.
Yes.
So I have seen that. I've seen folks kind of, like, have either mental health breaks or to kind of, like, fall back onto substance use. Mm-hmm. I've seen folks, like, they get a job and that job is like a vampire just sucking them dry, whether by time or context. I've seen people be disrespected by their employers. But I also, yeah, I mean, I think the individual experience, and we kind of, like, are in the middle of grappling with some of that, you know, for Joe here on the panel, is like, this, and I think this happens a lot, there's, like, excitement, and as Joe said, like, people feeling like $1 million when they get out, and then kind of, like, hitting the situation where, like, it's not, like, overconfidence seems like a derogatory assessment, but it is this form of confidence and excitement that then, when rubber meets the road, and is, like, maybe not even their own shortcoming, but just the world, really, like, the road is not even there, and the car is just still falling, like, am I gonna hit road in a minute or not? And, you know, when road hits, it's like you're already falling at 100 miles an hour and you just get smashed. And it seems like those situations that push people back to their old problems and habits. Like, you know, Mark, who knows where that man is right now?
Yes.
He came out and he was like, this is my last time. I'm doing good. Focus on my mental health. I got my phone. That was stressful. I'm just chilling at home for the rest of the day. And we got to a point where he was ready to, like, go do some stand-up. And it was wild. I have some photos from that time. He was expecting his jokes to hit like they were on the inside. But it's interesting because on the inside, dudes, like, knew him, right? And they were like, oh, this is Mark really doing his thing. And then, you know, when he was on stage and he had that very real and normal kind of, like, people aren't really trying to laugh, until you really, like, hand it to him. And he, like, afterwards, he just was kind of sweating bullets, and he was like, that was hard, you know, and he wasn't really prepared for the reality of it. You know,
absolutely.
He was so hyped that he wasn't really prepared for the reality. And, you know, it's not a problem, but it kind of was something that he was hoping to be able to lean on to, like, provide support. And it just was normal hard, right? But for someone who's facing historic trauma, a lack of comfort and familiarity with the whole situation, it's hard and not as gratifying as it seems. And I don't think comedy specifically is related to Mark's relapse, but it's just an example of something that's very normal that can create a situation that's ultimately totally destabilizing, and then compounded with lack of support, or even with support, the maximum resources you have are limited. And then ultimately, like, Mark did have a former wife and children, and, like, those people, whether they are aware of it or not, or even willing or unwilling to hold space for, ultimately has folks more or less dealing with their stuff alone. So that's kind of, like, the broad synopsis of what coming home might be like.
So to just, because I know Mark also, and his story is a perfect story. Before we get to Armand to take a song home, Yeah, they're in my ear telling me to shut the fuck up, but I'm going to say what I need to say and get to Armand. When we're inside, we have concrete plans, and ain't nothing going to stop these plans when I get home, because I done thought about this every day for 5 years. And when that one plan don't go, that's usually when you see the spiral. And Mark was comfortable not understanding that a lot of people was laughing at him, not with him.
Yeah.
And I was one of the guys who tried to explain to him that, bro, you funny because you look funny, and you're funny because this is what we expect from you. Mm-hmm. And but because we had the conversation about, I see him on the outside. We went to VOA together. We went to treatment together. And I had these conversations with him like, it's going to be different. It's going to be different because these people don't know you, so they're not going to get you. And I didn't know what happened from that point. Once I graduated and went on, I didn't know what happened, and now I do. But yeah, we get these one concrete plans that people tell us is going to work, and we're going to stick with it because it worked in prison. And when that don't happen, it usually sends us on a downward spiral. Before we get out of here, I would like to hear from Armand. Anything you would like to say about, you know, your first 30 days coming home, or just the mindset of the people who had to deal with you, not the people you had to deal with, but the people who had to deal with you and try to, you know, probably find yourself in a position where they didn't understand why you couldn't make a certain decision or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, on like, as I was saying, like, on a real practical level, like, even doing 13 months, which, again, it's sad, but that's considered, like, in the system's eyes, that's like baby time.
Mm-hmm.
But even coming in and doing 13 months, as I've told you guys before, a gentleman was there with my family to greet me and asked for my number, and I said, where's the pen and pencil at? They're like, oh, well, we have cell phones now. I was like, what is, that's a thing. I forgot about that. And then I remember not even wanting to interact with the phone itself, like, just like, get this thing out, like, out of my face. Like,
absolutely.
And what it was just like years of trauma meets just like welcome back. And for me, I couldn't see that at the time, but I was at my parents' house, which I hadn't been at my, I'm looking back now where I'm at in my life. I'm blessed that I have a mom and a dad. Mm-hmm. I'm blessed. But at the time, I was like, bro, I haven't been here since I was a teenager.
And absolutely. Now I'm a
27-year-old grown-ass man at his mama's house, having it, like, dealing with their substance abuse, their way of lifestyle, their certain unhealthy habits. And now I'm trying to say, better myself. Mm-hmm. Around all this, and it's just like, then you start, I remember retreating back and just being like, bro, you ain't the man no more. All that stuff you had is gone.
Yeah.
All the material items, gone. The whole apartment, gone. Everything, girl, you got that one, gone. Left you another one. But I wasn't living in a grateful place at that moment, you know?
Absolutely.
And it took me months before I hit certain walls with, you know, substances.
Yes.
And had lapses where, you know, not to say something, to say something that I could be back. They got time hanging over my head.
Absolutely.
They got 60 months hanging over my head. And sometimes I've walked around like, that's not even there like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When I know, besides the time over the head, if I'm not living righteous, if I'm not living a righteous life, whatever that means to me, I'm not going to get where I want.
Absolutely.
So it, again, back to the first 30 days out, yes, I was confused by technological things and,
mm-hmm.
and did not know what to order at a restaurant. I could not pick anything for easily a month, and I didn't know where to go for food, and I was on autopilot. And thank God I had some pieces by. It took me kind of a long place to just even be grateful that I wasn't completely victim to, like, how bad it could be, you know what I mean? As far as coming out with absolutely ain't zero, like, not even a friend. There are people that get out there with not even someone to call.
Absolutely.
So I was just blessed. I just knew how lucky I was not to be that person. That's my take, you know?
Absolutely. Thank you for that, Armand. We appreciate it. Hey, man. This is 10K Phone, man. This is Gang. This is your guy, Misfit Adi. We'll be back with another episode. Ah!
Hey, take your phone.
You are listening to the Tin Can Phone Podcast, where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell the story from the inside out. So make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m. You can also check us out on Spotify, Apple, and anywhere you catch your podcasts. And make sure to give us a follow over at tincanphonepodcast.com. See you next time.
was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. In short, the period was very much like the present period.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO